Hello everyone, welcome to In Your Nature. This is our second episode in Season 2, Episode 8, not to confuse everyone. Hi Niall, how's things?
Hi Ricky, I'm good thanks, how are you?
I'm very good. We are fresh back on the In Your Nature podcast, which is great. We just wrapped up our Swift podcast last week, and today we're talking about the Shannon Callows, which is an exciting topic and plenty to talk about there.
Yeah, it's an area where, of course, we in Birdwatch Ireland have a long history, so looking forward to talking about it very much in this podcast. And speaking of podcasts, just to say, In Your Nature is made in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, with the support of the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, the National Biodiversity Action Plan and the Heritage Council. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.
Super. So this week we spoke to a very, very expert person in the Shannon Callows, and that is our dear colleague Catherine Finney, who was born and bred basically in the Callows and grew up to be a breeding waiter expert. So we'll go across to the interview and we'll see what Catherine had to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up right in the banks of the Shannon, right in the heartlands of the Shannon Callows. So I come from a farm within the Shannon Callows, so kind of really understand the landscape and the kind of the farming systems in the Callows.
Really, it's the farming systems that really have kept the birds there as long as they're there, and have actually probably attracted most of the species there in the first place. So can you tell me what is a callow?
A callow, really, it's land that floods during winter. So the Shannon Callows, they're kind of the Shannon in the middle section, it floods during winter. It's very shallow gradient, so when water builds, or when high rainfall at times, it gets inundated very easily. And really the kind of the grasslands and the agricultural system that is operated in the Callows is based on the fact that it's underwater for about 6 months of the year.
So basically the farmers have surrendered to the fact that they just can't farm it for 6 months of the year. They don't try. They're not acting the maggot trying to drain everything when just the water is coming one way or another.
The water's coming one way or other. Yeah, very much so. I mean, now absolutely kind of that's changed over the years. Flooding patterns have definitely changed since I was a child on the Callows. But yes, largely it's just considered that it's summer grazing or summer management only. And all the farmers, of course, would have backland, land that doesn't flood.
And you mentioned there the middle section of the Callows. So what is the extent of the Callows? So when we obviously have the Banagher office, and I know the Callows as the area, sort of a radius around Banagher is sort of what I always had in my head. But where does the Shannon Callows extend to and from?
It's athlone to Pertumna and along the Little Brosna and along the River Suck. It's a very defined area, but it's very much the middle section of the River Shannon.
And are there other Callows in the country, or do we just call them floodplains everywhere else, or is the Shannon some way special, the geography there? What makes it so different?
No, I mean, there are other floodplains, and they would probably be, you know, it depends locally, they'd be kind of known. They might be known as the kind of the wet grassland area or the callow area, but it's the only place in the country I've really come across where the Callows is very much, if you say it to anyone in the locality, the Calla, they know where you're talking about. It's quite different.
Looking at Google Map, if people sort of have a look around, well, basically anywhere between Athlone and Pertumna, as you say, there's a lot of big islands on the Shannon.
Yeah, there's some really...
And they're special there as well, aren't they? They're very important for the wildlife and the plants.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the best breeding waiter spots in the whole of the Shannon Callows would be along one of the largest islands in it, which would be kind of Inishy Island, which is a 30-hectare island. So, I mean, some of these islands, they're not small. They're 30, 40, 50 hectares, possibly. You'd have them, some of them would be smaller. They'd be maybe 9, 10 hectares. But these are really important areas.
But they're all, I mean, a lot of them are big enough to be grazed as well.
Oh, absolutely. And the farmers have to swim their stock out onto those islands every season.
Yeah, that's class.
And it really is. It's obviously very difficult for them, but it's an incredible feat to get them out, you know, to get the stock out. And it's something that, you know, really needs to be recognised, because if these islands become kind of undergrazed or farmers stop putting in that effort to do that, they're really going to affect kind of the quality of the grassland on them and also their value for breeding waders. So it's really important.
You're just going to get, the islands are just going to scrub over, and they're
totally
going to become more important for warblers and things than they are for waders, which in one sense, okay, you could argue, okay, that's deadly. But in another sense, it's a landscape that floods, and the species are supposed to be your curlews, your redshank, your snipe, your godwits. And that's what we're used to. And talking about flooding, we did a podcast with Catherine Farrell about bogs, and I mentioned flooding. She gave out to me for mentioning the word flooding in the context of bogs, but we're allowed to talk about it here in the context of rivers. I've been to your home place, and the flood was uncomfortably high for me. Now, I don't know if that was a particular... But it was literally, I could have spat from your front step into the floodwater.
Yeah.
Like, is that a normal thing for people to live with it down there? It's just bananas.
It depends. The flood that you were talking about, when you visited my house, that was a particularly big flood. So that was a kind of, about, I think, 2009, there was a particularly big winter flood. It would not normally get quite that close. That was a little bit too close for comfort, really. But, I mean, you know, the whole fields in front of our house would be flooded on a normal winter flood year. And I suppose people just, yeah, it's just part of the landscape. I mean, they don't even think about it. And really, I don't think growing up in the area, I would have really considered it until I left and, you know, went away and went travelling and actually came back and realised how unique a system, how unique a landscape it is that I live in.
When I first started working down in the Banner office, I remember seeing the first proper flood from the hill, coming down the hill into Banagher, looking out over the Callows. It was like an ocean. I just couldn't believe it. I was like, oh God, something has went badly wrong here.
Yeah, I mean, the scale is massive. And I don't think, when you are standing with people who only see it in summer, they just can't get their heads around it. It's just such a completely different landscape. Sure, I remember having you out in the island, you know, doing the work on the wader fence. And just trying to get that concept to the volunteers who were out there that what you were standing with was underwater completely maybe 3-4 weeks ago and was underwater for like 6 months of the year, up to 6 months of the year, and could be underwater again in a month or two if we had a summer flood. I mean, it's very hard to wrap your head around it because it looks like such a solid, stable landscape.
So we've been talking now for a few minutes and we've barely mentioned any birds. Tell me first about the breeding waders on the Callows.
Right. Well, you've got kind of the four of the main breeding wader species. They all breed in the Callows. So you've got redshank, snipe, curlew and lapwing. And the Callows are really kind of a national bastion for these species. They are a national stronghold and they have probably a significant proportion of the national breeding population of all these four species. And
are they all on the islands or are they on the banks as well?
No, they're on the islands, they're on the mainland as well. Predominantly waders would be kind of on the grassland areas, but you will find them in the meadow areas as well. But yeah, so they're kind of right scattered throughout. I mean, at this point, when the Callows were designated as an SAC and an SPA, and it's probably important to say that they're two of the highest European designations.
When was that?
In 1987. An SPA for birds and an SAC for the habitats. So it's dual designation. And it's just it's a recognition of how completely important on a European context this landscape is. But when they were designated, the population of breeding waders was much higher than it is now. And the population of these species right across the Ireland was much higher. And what's happened really is that as agricultural intensification and land drainage has affected the kind of the distribution of these species in the wider countryside, because the Callows can't be intensified the same way that other agricultural landscapes have over the past 40 years, it means that a lot of the habitats and a lot of the species have actually hung on here and they're retained here because they're not under the same intensification pressure that they are in the rest of the country.
I know there's a caveat here, but can't talk about the Callows without mentioning corncrake.
Absolutely.
Which are now extinct in the Callows, yeah. But a lot of people did a lot of things. The farmers went bent over backwards, yeah, to try retain the corncrake. But the actual summer May floods were basically the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of corncrake. Am I right to say that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose it's kind of two factors. The corncrake were already in decline. And I think had the conservation measures been in place maybe 10 years earlier, the population would have been a lot more robust. But what happened was is the population, which had been initially kind of had declined because of, you know, there is a level of intensification in the Callows, but it had initially declined because of that. So that by the time we started getting summer floods, and we got a series of summer floods, I think in about 15 years, we had 12 summer floods. And a summer flood in the Callows is anything from May to September. And that really put the death nail in the corncrake, because the corncrake is double brooded. they're very short-lived birds. They only live for 2 or 3 years. And in order for the population to remain even stable, they need to be successful in both broods. So if you have a flood event anytime between May and September, you're going to possibly impact on one or other of their broods. And of course, the ground nesting species. So it just meant that their nests got flooded.
No, and it's awful to think. And we still to this very day, and probably right now, because we're not actually in the office at the minute, we're all working from home. But right now, the phone in Banagher is probably ringing with someone with an inquiry about corncrakes. Yeah. Come and see them, because that hangover is still there. People still believe the corncrake breed in the Callows, and they'll tell you, like, people older than us, sort of people in their 50s plus, I suppose, will remember good populations of corncrake, not only in the Callows, even further out in the wider countryside around the country. It's just awful. I mean, conservationists of our generation are just really appalled by what we're facing. But
yeah.
I will also like to say, and I think it's fair to say, that what was learned in the Callows and the ecology of corncrake and some of the conservation approaches and techniques that were honed in the Callows have now been used in a lot of other places, and we see the Curlew EIP up in the west now using a lot of those techniques that were figured out back then. So all is not lost, and there is good work coming out of that. And equally, tell me a bit about the island and the fence, and how predator fences and things have become so important to breeding waders these days.
Well, back when I started with Birdwatch, kind of quite early on in my career, we looked at why breeding waders were in decline right across nationally, and why they were in decline in the Callows. And we put in place a research project. So we kind of figured, is that if they're in decline in the Callows, what is going on in the Callows? Because it's not suffering from the same type of intensification as the wider countryside. So we tried to get to the bottom of it. So we put up a research project, and really very, very early on, we discovered that while the population might look like it was stable and it was, you know, numbers were good, productivity of fledgling productivity every year was close on zero, and it was predation. We had little nest monitors on nests, so we could tell exactly, you know, what had predated the nest. We even did some DNA analysis on fragments.
What was the suite of predators?
Main predators were fox, mink, and grey crow and magpie. And this is pretty much, those suite of predators have been found to be the kind of main suite of predators for all ground nesting birds. You know, hen harrier, tern, there's a whole suite of ground nesting birds that are...
But you do get other surprising ones. I mean, people are always aghast to find out that hedgehogs will have a nibble on a wader nest quite happily. And I don't know, I'm sure there are others. I always think hedgehogs just would not do such a thing at all.
No, they do. And I mean, I suppose this is it. Anything with a mouth is a predator for a wader egg or a wader chick. I mean, there's no kind of hard and fast. It is literally, if it has a mouth or a beak, it is a predator. So you'll get everything will predate on waders. But most of the other species, they're occasional. They're not the species driving the kind of declines.
Before we go off down that road, let's bring back to the fence.
Yeah. So back in 2009, we had realised that actually, you know, the predator problem in on this particular island, which was the highest density site in the whole of the Callows, and one of the, I'd say probably the highest density wader site in possibly nationally, we realised the predator problem was just so huge that we couldn't actually get on top of it ourselves. So we decided to put up a fox and mink proof predator fence completely around the island. So, and as you know, Ricky, that fence took a lot to put up and took a lot to maintain.
Well, describe the fence. Like, why? Well, how is it any different than your standard kind of deer wire fence?
Well, to be mink proof, everything has to be to a 2-inch scale. And to be fox proof, it needs to be kind of a certain height. So it would, standard height at that stage would have been about 122, 125 centimetres high. It had an L shape, so it had a skirting. So it was effectively sheep wire overlain with chicken wire, folded out at the bottom to an L shape, and then the bottom skirting pinned down to make sure it didn't lift and nothing could get in underneath it. And then you had a couple of strands of electric wire at the top, just the top, to kind of make sure that anything that climbed it was going to hit an electric wire. But obviously, this is on a 30-hectare island in the Shannon that floods for 6 months of the year. So there was considerable maintenance every single year to get that fence back up and running in advance of the breeding season. You know, if so much as a tiny bit of the chicken wire got ripped during the winter flood, it had to be found. That rip had to be found. It had to be patched.
Which is fine if it was all concrete ground and there wasn't vegetation and bits of logs and everything hiding it. It was painstaking, and many a young conservationist cut their teeth on that fence.
They put a few through my hands, all right.
So that was good crack. Look, it didn't kill us. No, and that did it work? Did the fence work?
Yeah, I mean, when the fence went up, there were 9 pairs of, the population had declined to 9 pairs of waders on the site by 2000.
Nine pairs of waders, so all species?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
By 2013, the population was up in 101 pairs. So it worked incredibly well. So, in addition, it's probably worth noting as well is that farmer was under a management agreement. So he was kind of sympathetically managing the land for breeding waders. And we also cut our teeth and trialled some of the measures that we're using elsewhere in the country, as you said, for waders in other areas of the country and for the curlew EIP in terms of, you know, reprofiling drains to make them suitable for chicks to feed, kind of putting in wader ponds, removing scrub, which is predator habitat, and increasing.
There's two types of people in this world. There is the type that want to blame farmers for everything. That's not true, and farmers don't go rub their hands every morning and say, let's kill a few waders. That is not what happens. So the EIPs and various things are working with farmers quite a lot. And back in the day, I mean, people will probably remember the measure to harvest the hay or whatever from the inside out to allow mammy corncrakes and her chicks sort of refuge in the edges of the field.
Yeah.
That was one of the old-fashioned ones. For farmers or people who don't understand what farmers are asked to do, maybe give some of those measures the type of examples of what they do to help.
Generally, you'd be looking for them to produce a particular type of kind of sward structure during the breeding season. And they do that by grazing. By grass, yeah. And they do that by grazing in a sympathetic manner. Now, on the one hand, we want them to produce the kind of that particular kind of sward structure, which would be kind of a mix of short and long bits. But we also don't want too many stock on the field, because too many stock could lead to trampling of eggs and nests. So there'd be stocking restrictions, but they still have to achieve the kind of what we're looking for in the sward. There would be restrictions on tractor operations, fertilizer, any tractor operation at all, because obviously if you have a tractor kind of rolling, you know, going in and out of the field, it's going to cause damage. Fertilizer, if you fertilize an area, it doesn't produce the sward that, you know, the waders like to nest in or chick rear in. So they'd all be doing that, you know, all those elements. And then at the back end of the year, it doesn't just stop in the breeding season. At the back end of the year, they'd be getting the sward ready for the next season. So they'd be getting their habitat ready for the next breeding season. So come kind of August, September, they're already managing that land to make it suitable for the following kind of March, April. We'd also be looking for them to do, in some instances, maybe look at putting in wet features for the chicks to feed, look at reprofiling the ones that they have, or removing predator habitat to, you know, encroaching scrub or trees.
They're basically used as lookout posts for hooded crows to watch breeding waders go return to the nest, so they can identify where the eggs are. And we try basically remove those from the landscape as much as possible.
We remove those, and also that's cover for fox or mink as well that would be hiding in it. So, and in addition to that, it also decreases the amount of available habitat for the waders, because they won't nest in those sort of areas. They won't nest near them or in them. So if you have a population that's expanding, you want to make sure that it has enough suitable habitat to expand into. But I think you made a really good point, Ricky, in relation to the farmers. I mean, I've been working with farmers, you know, my entire career, and they are so helpful. What they're willing to do and the measures that they're willing to carry out go far over and above like normal practice in a lot of instances. And, they are just so willing to embrace it and take it on board. And I think the key to that is we've always operated Birdwatch Ireland, any of the schemes we're trialling or designing, or even the IPs, specialist advisory. So we're working kind of closely with them. We're training them. We're, you know, giving them workshops. We're explaining the, you know, the why, you know, and the how of what they're doing. And they really do embrace it. And certainly there's so much good conservation, whether it be Corncrake or Windchat or Breeding Waders, has come out of actually working with farmers in the Shannon Callows. Aspects of national conservation that have had their roots in being trialled in the Shannon Callows. And very, very often in these instances, the farmers, they weren't being paid for it. They weren't, you know, it was new, it was cutting edge. You know, nobody knew really how it was going to work. And the farmers just got behind it and embraced it.
How are the birds doing on the callows now?
The breeding measure is now in gloss. So there are farmers currently managing their land for breeding waders under gloss. There's also an MPWS breeding wader farm plan scheme for kind of more, some of the more important areas.
So gloss is basically farm payments for farmers who do various measures for birds, whatever they may be. So
yeah, it would have been the measure we were trialling during the breeding waiter project. Unfortunately, that doesn't have a specialist advisory element to it at the moment. And in terms of how the population is doing under the gloss measure or currently as it stands, we don't really know at the moment. Although MPWS are carrying out some breeding waiter surveys this year, so we should all hopefully some data. Yeah.
But Katrin and I talked an awful lot about sort of farmers' input, the landscape, how it's been managed, how it came to be so important for birds. But we didn't go into too much detail on many of the species. So we mentioned the word waders quite a bit. Can you qualify what exactly a wader is for our listeners?
So in general terms, waders are birds that you would very much associate with water, not so much swimming, although there are some species that swim, but they'd be found around the shorelines, and that could be in fresh water, it could be on the coasts, at estuaries, mudflats, in brackish water. But essentially, they're a group of generally long-legged, fairly long-beaked birds that wade into water. And many of them are highly migratory, and Ireland, given our geographic position, we attract in lots of these species. There's a few that breed here with us, and as we heard there from Catherine, a lot of our breeding waders, they're having a hard time of it, have been for quite a while. But then in the winter, we get a big influx of waders, some of those species, but many other species as well, that visit many wetlands around Ireland. So Ireland really punches above its weight when it comes to waders. And I think a lot of bird watchers, when they start watching birds, they think of the waders as being very difficult. So they're a difficult group to get to grips with. But I would say people should persevere because they are wonderful birds. They really are a real treat to get to know. We have so many species here. It's such a diversity within Ireland, and they link us with many other countries around the world. You know, to think that some of those birds, like turnstones, the type of waders you find in coast layers, they're breeding in Greenland and in northern Canada, and they're coming to spend the winter with us here. You've other ones coming in from Siberia, loads from Scandinavia, lots down from Iceland, like the black-tailed godwit, which is a bird I always associate with the Shannon Callows as well, because there have actually been breeding attempts of that species in the past in the Shannon Callows as well, a bird we normally associate with Iceland. But these birds as well, people think of them as being kind of drab and boring in some ways, and that's why people should pay more attention to our breeding waders, because in breeding plumage, a lot of those birds you think of as being brown and grey, they are stunners. So I think that's really important. And I always, when people say waders are boring, I always point out, well, look at a lapwing. A lapwing is not boring in the slightest. That is one stunning looking bird and sounds amazing as well. The sounds are great too. People don't often hear the songs of these waders, but when they're breeding you do, and they're great singers. They're almost like songbirds. They have their own kind of dawn chorus almost.
Yeah, no, they're beautiful, and unfortunately a lot of people will never, not never hear them, but mightn't hear them in Ireland, because they don't nest in or breed in huge densities in Ireland like they do up in northern climes in sort of Iceland, Siberia, northern Scotland, on the islands and stuff. So we are a little bit impoverished that way for big breeding wader populations and areas. But let's play a couple that we mentioned. So let's first listen to Red Shag.
Classic sound. I love it. It's great. And you in places like the Shannon Callows, where there is still a population of these birds, they'll often sing from the top of fence posts. You'll see them perching up there. It's not something we think of waders as doing. We think of them as being on the ground the whole time. But they'll perch in trees, they'll perch on fence posts, and they'll do this song. We only really, most of the time, we just see part of their lives in the winter, but the summer is quite different.
Yeah, and let's go for Blacktail Godwit here.
Again, more vocal than people would expect. They really do try to impress. They do these song flights. They'll also perch on posts and will fly up into the air, sort of in the same way that a skylark will, almost to an extent. And they do a performance in the sky, which I think is amazing. So yeah, beautiful to hear that. And that's another wager where the difference between the summer and the winter plumage couldn't be more striking. In the winter, they're, let's be honest, they're fairly drab, grey-looking birds.
They're gratings. Yeah.
But then in breeding plumage, they're this wonderful orange-reddish colour with barring on them and all spangling on the back. They're a really remarkable looking bird.
And also in winter, you often find them in our estuaries and places like the Callows in hundreds and thousands. So they can just form this big grey roosting lump. So they can be hard to penetrate and sort of pick out. So they are, I suppose, a little bit tricky in that way. But like you say, when they're in breeding plumage, it's a different sport altogether.
And then one of our bigger waders as well. They're, you know, substantial enough birds. They're related to curlews. They're not quite as big as a curlew, but they're not far off. They're a large enough bird. One of the bigger waders that you'd see, certainly bigger than a redshank or bigger than a Dunlin as well.
The other thing that we spoke of, we focused a lot on the breeding birds in the Callows. And that's one of its strongest sort of cards, I suppose. But the other thing the Callows is famous for, of course, is the wintering wild birds there. And it's an internationally important site for various species, including the mute swan, which are found there in their hundreds, the hooper swan, which comes down to spend the winter here. It's also important for widgeon, for golden plover, for lapwing, I believe. So, like, you get hundreds and thousands of waders, like I described earlier, in the Callows, in the Little Brosna and on the Shannon. During the winter, depending on where the floodwaters are, and those conditions just suit them perfectly.
Absolutely, and the way the landscape just transforms. If you're there in the summer, as you and Catherine are discussing, you would not believe in the winter this is a place where you could get thousands of ducks and loads of swans coming in. You think, this is a grassy meadow with lots of wildflowers. How could there possibly be any waterfowl coming in here? But it transforms completely, and it's perfect. It's perfect habitat for them as well, because it's just the right depth. You know, it's well flooded, extensive water, but it's not massively deep. So a lot of these birds, they don't have to go too far below the surface to find food, and so that suits the dabbling species very well, the ones that don't completely dive below the surface.
But it makes the area a bit impenetrable for humans, so which suits them again, and it's one of the reasons why they hang out there, because the disturbance level is so low. And I rang Brian in Banagher earlier to actually try pick his brains so we could suggest some good vantage points if people did want to get down there in the winter to try check out the wintering wild birds down in the Callows. But like, he was kind of stumped. He suggested Shannon Harbour, but without sort of describing these mad little lanes and local byways and difficult places to describe, there's not really a kind of handy VP over the whole site that you can sort of set up shop and look over the Callows. Unfortunately, it's an extensive area, and the birds kind of get around. It's a bit dynamic.
It is, and it's very flat as well. So yeah, you can't really get any high ground which to survey or look over it. So it is tricky. I think that people are doing that. Obviously, be careful you don't get cut off by flood water in the winter. But it's just it's a nice place to explore. You never know what you might come across. You know, it really is a good spot. And as you said, because that water provides so much protection for those birds in the winter too, they do really well. Also, well worth a visit in the summer months. So sadly, the corncrakes, as we heard, are no longer there. I remember back in the 1990s going there to hear the corncrakes, and they were very reliable, but it's a shame they've disappeared. But don't let that put you off, because as we heard, there's lots of breeding waders there and lots of other birds too. But also, it's of great botanical interest. The wildflowers there are like nowhere else in Ireland. It's incredible. And because of the way in which the land floods, it means that it's incredibly fertile. So it means that there's lots of natural silt and everything aggregating there, and also some of the droppings from the birds that are there in the winter, all of these widgeon and hooper swans, they're fertilizing that soil. When the floodwaters then recede, all of that nitrogen goes into the ground and promotes the growth of so many different wildflowers. And of course, when that happens, you get so many insects. So it's certainly a place that I've been there with a few Birdwatch Ireland branches. We've done trips there in the past. In the middle of the summer, if you suffer from hay fever, you want to be very careful, because I've never seen anything like the hay fever suffering that happens in the Callows, because there's so much pollen around from flowers and from grass that it can be very severe. So just do bear that in mind if you suffer from hay fever. But it's really a unique landscape within Ireland, because it hasn't suffered from the same degree of intensification as much of our other arable land. I mean, there has been some, as Catherine was saying, saying, but certainly it's quite different from what from the landscape that most people would expect.
Yeah, no, it's good, and the flood has literally kept it back in the kind of in farming. It's held it back agricultural wise, and kind of reminds me of parts of rural Poland where things are still done in a very sort of piecemeal way and low intensity and low machinery. And just even Catherine describing how the local landowners and graziers have to swim the cattle across the river, it just sounds like a bit medieval. It's amazing. It's cool. It's a cool spot. And if it was somewhere else in Europe, there would be a brochure for it in the bird watching magazines and on the stands and stuff. People would go there and to see the species, and you're going to see birds if you go there, winter or summer. And we talk about winter water birds. We're talking about herons. We're talking about ducks. We're talking about geese. We're talking about swans. We're talking about grebes. You're going to see stuff if you drive around, and there's lovely little villages around there along the Shannon. So this is the Offaly East Galway tourist board telling you to go go and check these places out. It's really lovely. You talked about the grassland there as well, and this is bringing us now to Bird of the Week. The grassland there, the sort of lovely flowering meadows, it gives rise to the habitat, a suitable habitat for a very special species that not many people will have come across, probably. It's the whinchat.
Yes, whinchat, a very little known bird within Ireland and a very sparsely distributed one. The Shannon Callows is one of the best areas for them, one of the most reliable, because again, this is an insect eating bird, especially during the summer when because they're migrants, so they're only here in the summer. They have to feed their hungry chicks back in the nest. So if they're in an area that's rich in insect life, then they're going to be doing really well. And they like flat landscape with isolated bushes and perches and fence posts to be on. They're closely related to a bird that people might know a bit better, a bird called the stonechat. They're similar in many respects. They're the same size, a small little bird. They're in the same family as the robin, but they're a good bit smaller than a robin. But unlike the stonechat, there's a big white collar and a very black head, especially the breeding male does, the whinchat's a bit different. It's more sort of peachy, actually lovely sort of apricot peach-like wash on the chest. This strong white pale stripe over each eye, we call that a supercilium, and that really sticks out very, very strongly. And they have this charming habit of perching up on a low bush or on a fence maybe, and singing from there. And it's a lovely bird to connect with because they're really few and far between within Ireland. So the Callows is where I think, you know, we have one of the biggest concentrations of them in one spot.
Yeah, the male truly is stunning. The female and the female stonechat and winter stonechat, they kind of blend a bit. They look very similar, so people might get confused there. But I almost got cold feet on using whinchat as the bird of the week because they are difficult to connect with because they're just so sparsely distributed. They've got a fairly sort of widespread distribution, but such low density, I suppose, in spots. Over time, we've kind of tidied them up out of our wider countryside because the Irish name sums it up well. It translates as little gorse cow. So you find them in those gorsey, scrubby habitats on the edges of bogs. But those kind of places now are more in our uplands, and in more kind of, I suppose, you know, away from your sort of, you know, your cow grazed silage fields that is very, very sort of commonplace now across our countryside. So we've kind of squeezed them into the more marginal habitats, haven't we?
Yes, absolutely. And they've kind of have become very focused there. And I think what happens as well is that when bird watchers want to go and see them, there's certain hotspots that they will go to. So the species could actually be under-recorded. It could be more widespread than we suspect because people know that I want to see a whinchat this year. Well, I'm going to go to perhaps the Shannon Callows, as we said, or you could go to a place called Coronation Plantation in County Wicklow. It's very well known for them. If you go there in the summer, you have a very good chance of seeing them. So people tend to focus on that and not bother with the other spots. But we do know from the Countryside Bird Survey, they do turn up in fairly randomly in some other squares. You see them in migration as well, because unlike the stonechat, which is with us year round, these little whinchats, they migrate all the way to Africa, which is remarkable for such a tiny little creature. So they have a very wide range globally. They're found across most of Europe and well into Asia as well. And so we're at the very edge of their range. So often species at the edges of the range tend to be a bit more fragmented and a bit more scarce. But what's very interesting about that too, without getting too nerdy about all this, that across that whole vast range, which is, you know, many, many thousands of kilometres, there is no geographical variation in whinchats whatsoever. They don't have any different subspecies. Whereas you look at a bird like the stonechat, closely related, there's many different subspecies that all have different variants and look a bit different and sound a bit different. So it's very interesting how two different strategies have completely evolved in those two similar species.
I use, as you do and many other people, a very, very helpful website called Zenocanto. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially an audio library of bird calls and sounds and any sort of audio noise that a bird makes, it's on there. If you search a species, it'll give you the map of their distribution and their various subspecies and all that sort of stuff. I was shocked this morning to find that Windchat didn't have any other subspecies, like you've just mentioned. It normally, it's huge distribution to not have any sort of offshoots described, which is amazing. And on that note, because it's an audio website, let's listen to the song. I think it's very subtle, but it's also, it's got various things in it. It's quite complex, actually, I think.
It is, it is. You know, it's something you could dismiss, you know, if you're walking along in somewhere like the Callows, there'll be lots of other birds singing as well. So, you know, people sometimes can tune that one out or think maybe it doesn't stick out. If you isolate it like that and you listen to it carefully, there is a real beauty there. It's a lovely song. And that's the real key to how you find birds like this. It's listening for their songs and for their calls, because that's how we pick them up on so many of our surveys. I remember Dick Coombs, who obviously coordinates our Countryside Bird Survey for us in Birdwatch Ireland, he was telling me that, you know, the most important skill of all for the surveyors is to know as many birds as possible by ear, because the majority of some species are picked up by ear. Not just things like windchat, birds like wrens, for example. I think it's only 5% of the wrens in the survey are ever actually seen. The other 95% are by ear only. So if you don't know the songs and calls of the birds, you do miss them or underestimate the population.
No, totally. And I think the song there has, they are actually known mimics, not to the point of like mimicking car alarms and things, but other species rather. And I think it's got a very meadowy pipit and skylark tones, yes, there. Like, I think unless I was tuned in with my windchat radar well and truly, like, turned on, I think I would sort of, in the soundscape of the Shannon Callows, I think I would just throw that away and think it's kind of a distant meadow pipit or something going on. But it's really actually nice when you sit down and listen to it.
It is, and that concept of the mimicry is very interesting. This is something that's getting a lot of focus now, not just with windchats, but with many other birds, like white throats. They do a lot of mimicry. There's a bird called a marsh warbler, which is only a very, very rare visitor to Ireland, but they're amazing mimics. But what's really interesting is when you have mimicking species, like the windchat, that migrate to Africa, what we could be hearing during the summer as part of their song are some of the bird sounds that they're bringing back from Africa with them, like these souvenirs from another continent. I think that's amazing. So that song, there's more to it than meets the ear. It's really, really remarkable.
Yeah, it's like your mate that goes to Australia for a couple of years and then comes back with all these sort of mad CDs, didgeridoo and stuff. And you're like, and you're like, ooh, this is cool. And no, beautiful species. And listen, we've been purposely picking birds for Birds of the Week that people can connect with, because we don't want to sort of make it very inaccessible and strange, and we want people. But this, let's say this is a special bank holiday weekend special, and people are to Google windchats and get them on the radar and add them to their species list and go out there and have a look for them. And where's the spot in Wicklow?
Oh, Carnation Plantation. Oh, very, very reliable spot for them. A really weird looking landscape for those who don't know it. It almost looks, to me, it always reminds me of looking like the Serengeti or something, because there's weird plantation trees there. And yeah, it looks very, very odd and out of keeping with the rest of the landscape. But there's something about it that windchats really like. Good area for crossbills and birds like that as well. So a nice birding spot.
Oh, wow. Well, that's worth a visit itself. Yeah. And I actually have heard the name of that place 100 times, and I've never visited, so I got to check it out myself. That's all we've got time for. Another good episode, I hope, and people will enjoy it.
Just to say thanks to everybody for all the great feedback we've been getting. People have been very, very generous to us about saying they enjoy the podcast and they want us to keep up the good work. So thank you very much for listening to us. And as I always say, if you'd like to support that good work that Birdwatch Ireland does, we'd love to convince you to become members of ours. So please do join us. You'll find full details at birdwatchireland.ie. Just click on the Become a Member link there. Share that with your friends and family too. Convince them to join as well, because the more members we have, the more money we have to support this conservation work, but also the more clout it gives us when we're trying to get habitats protected and we're trying to persuade the powers that be to do the right thing. So you can really help us with that. And the way I say it, if you're interested enough in birds to listen to Ricky and me prattle on for this length of time about birds, you're interested enough to join Birdwatch Ireland. So please do.
Just to say, our next episode will be coming out a little bit early. It'll be coming out on Saturday the 12th of June, and that is to mark a very special occasion, which is Cruinniú na n-Óg, which is a very special sort of day for children in Ireland. But our special is based on questions we have been asked by children. And but I would say children ask the most complex questions, Niall. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Whenever you go to talk to a school group or something, you never know what you're going to be asked. It's much scarier than talking to an audience of adults, because adults are very restrained. They think, oh, no, that's a silly question. I shouldn't ask that. But there are no silly questions. Ask, that's what I say.
No, totally. And we had a lot of fun researching the answers and answering the questions. But by no means is it an episode for children. It is dedicated to children, but it will be enjoyed by everyone. So do tune in on from Saturday the 12th and check out that episode. This episode is made in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, with the support of the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, the National Biodiversity Action Plan and the Heritage Council. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.